Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hurricane Irma was bad enough in Florida, but much worse in the Caribbean. St. Martin, Barbuda just pounded. Once lush hillsides on the Virgin Islands, stripped clean, turned drab brown. These small islands are in crisis, and now another hurricane, Maria, bears down. This hour, On Point, the way forward for the Caribbean after Irma. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Were you, your family, or friends affected by Irma in the Caribbean? And what does the Caribbean look like in a climate change century? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we'll look at retirees rethinking Florida after Hurricane Irma. But the Caribbean, much, much worse hit. Here was Gaston Brown, Prime Minister of Antigua and Barbuda, telling Miami's public radio station WLRN last week that the island of Barbuda saw historic destruction.
For the first time in 300 years, Barbuda is uninhabited. The island has been totally evacuated. 95% of the buildings were damaged. The cost of the damage could probably get up to about $250 million. Barbuda today is a mangled wreck.
A mangled wreck in the British Virgin Islands. Here was British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson telling Sky News last week that what he saw there on the British Virgin Island of Tortola evoked the devastation caused by the atomic bomb in World War II.
It really does remind me of pictures of Hiroshima. But what really comes through just talking to people is the resilience. You know, everything's smashed, everything's broken, their homes are destroyed, but their spirits are completely unbowed.
On St. Martin, stores left standing, cleaned out by looters. One woman told Al Jazeera last week she was getting desperate.
Apparently they're giving out water, but we haven't received any yet. We have no electricity, no radio, so we don't know anything. And since this morning, I've been running everywhere to find milk for my little girl.
We have a reporter with us just back from the Caribbean. Joining me in the studio is David Abel, reporter for the Boston Globe. He was just in the U.S. Virgin Islands last week, chronicling the devastation caused by Hurricane Irma. David Abel, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much.
What did you see?
Well, what we just heard from some of the other islands was very reminiscent of what I had seen. I've covered all kinds of conflicts over the years and various natural disasters, but the extent of the destruction was so overwhelming. It was almost breathtaking.
Where were you? St. Thomas, St. John, both?
We took a boat from the east coast of Puerto Rico to St. John, and we also spent a bit of time on St. Thomas. St. John is pretty much, which is beside Tortola, was kind of the epicenter of the damage. And what was astounding to see was just homes and buildings that were reduced to their foundations everywhere, all over the island.
Wow.
And the vegetation shorn off trees. It was like winter had just come to the tropics instantly.
You didn't fly in. You came in by boat from Puerto Rico. What kind of boat and why that way?
So we went with what has been called the Puerto Rican Navy, which is this volunteer relief effort. And it was the only way to get to those islands. And we essentially joined a group of volunteers that were bringing generators and baby food and bug spray and you name it to try to help the people remaining on those islands who are trapped and are living in something like a black hole where there is very little communication. And it took almost a week for the U.S. government and the military to really make a sizable presence on the island, which was just happening as we arrived Tuesday morning.
These are tropical Caribbean islands. They know hurricanes. They've seen plenty before. Were people in the U.S. Virgin Islands telling you this is different?
Yes. So There were things that were distinct about Irma that I think make it different than almost any other storm. Just to give you a couple of ideas about what distinguishes this what was a Category 5 hurricane. It had sustained 185-mile-per-hour maximum winds that lasted longer than any other hurricane or cyclone ever, as far as recorded. That was 37 hours compared to the 24 hours of the last record, which was Haiyan, which hit the Philippines. And I believe it was the Philippines.
Yes.
And it was a Category 5 hurricane for 3.25 days, which tied the longest previous record, which was a hurricane in 1932. And we are talking about a direct hit at massive winds that just tore off roofs like they were tin cans and shattered windows and tore down walls. And I heard the most harrowing stories of people who were in their homes hiding underneath mattresses in bathrooms trying to find any shelter and then having to run for cover when their homes blew apart.
And not just built structures that were devastated, but you've been looking at the natural environment itself. The hillsides denuded.
And there's one thing about seeing destruction in the sense of like bombs hitting buildings. And there is something else, as if what I believe was one of the officials in that we just heard at the top of the hour here saying how it looked as if a nuclear bomb went off. And when people say that, what they're talking about is what makes these places beautiful, what makes these islands distinct is their greenery, is how lush they are.
Yeah,
and these flowing vines and bougainvillea that mm-hmm. flow into the sea. And it was all gone. Every tree, every palm tree lacked fronds. It was just like a different place. People we who were giving us tours of the island said they didn't recognize it. They could see through places they had never seen before.
We've seen it from the air. It looks brown. Islands we think of as green, green, green.
And it's just denuded of vegetation and completely. And you go around along the coast and you see boats beached on, belly up as if they were hit by torpedoes. And it looks like the landscape was torched, essentially.
We've got people who were there. David Abel just back, or the Boston Globe, just back from the Caribbean. Michelle in Miami. Thank you for calling, Michelle. What have you seen?
I actually got into St. John on Sunday, and we left there Thursday the following week was when we were finally able to leave to go to Puerto Rico.
Wait, so were you there when Irma hit, Michelle?
Yeah, I was there on Tuesday when it hit, straight Category 5. I was at the Westin Resort that was on the south side of the island, from what I was told.
What was that like? How did you ride it out? What were the circumstances?
They moved everybody from the older buildings, the ones that were closest to the water, closest to the pool. They moved them to the newer ones. Fortunately, I was already in that building. But we still saw that same destruction. We still saw the roofs of the resort just being blown off. Those safest ones that we were at, even those had a lot of damage. Our impact windows actually burst through the first layer, but the second layer luckily held up, and we got water in our unit. But for the most part, like exactly what they said, everything that was green just turned brown. It looked like just destruction.
David, what are you thinking as you hear from Michelle? Stick with us, Michelle.
Well, I was just at the Westin a few days ago, and more than half of the villas there have been thoroughly ruined, and they are estimating it's going to cost upwards of $90 million just to repair that one resort and bring it back online.
Michelle, how did you eventually get out? How did you get off St. John?
Well, kind of crazy story. They did tell us once we started getting a little bit of cell phone signal that with their satellite phones, they weren't able to reach their corporate offices, so they asked us to reach out to our friends and family and get on social media. They told us to tweet the Coast Guard, Facebook, whoever we could that we knew that might be able to assist to bring attention to us, because from what they told us, no one knew we were there. From there, that Thursday, we finally got word that we were going to be getting boats coming in, some taxis that were taking us either to St. Croix or to Puerto Rico, which fortunately we got off to Puerto Rico. And at that time, they told us as well, if we have to be here another day, we're going to have to bring your meals down from 2 to 1, and we probably have about 60 hours left in our generator. So their main goal at that point was to get us off before Jose got near.
And you were at a resort. Wow, that's tweet the Coast Guard. That's kind of incredible. Michelle, who lived through it there on St. John. And, of course, the destruction wider than just the U.S. Virgin Islands. Michelle, thanks for your call. Here's a San Martin resident driving around the island, surveying the damage, taking stock of everything that was lost. This is a video produced by the New York Times.
We don't have electricity. We don't have water. We don't have phones. We don't have internet, anything. There is a lot of damage. People are crying on the streets. They don't have nowhere to go. There were places where there were houses, and now there is nothing. Not even a piece of wood, nothing.
Not even a piece of wood, nothing. David Abel is just back from St. Thomas and St. John's. Are people still leaving? Are they getting out while it's going to be rebuilt? How long is it going to take to rebuild?
Well, while we were there, there were hundreds of people lined up. It looked like refugees. The Coast Guard had just arrived in force when we were arriving. There were four cutters right off the coast, and they were taking people off the main docket at Cruz Bay and taking them on speedboats to cutters and then to cruise ships and then to planes, hopefully, to the mainland. But right now, I think people are in jeopardy again because there's a hurricane by the name of Maria that is due to hit in the same islands, and in particular the Virgin Islands, potentially at a Category 4 strength.
Very strong.
This Wednesday. And I hope that all of the people that are on those islands are preparing and taking cover, but they are far more vulnerable now than they were during the last storm because I would say 80% of the roofs on those islands are gone. And they're now basically being covered, a lot of them, by blue FEMA tarps.
Yeah.
And that is not going to withstand a Category 4 hurricane.
David, were islanders saying to you, we've been here before, we'll rebuild, we'll be back? Or was it too soon to say that? Or were they even wondering, seas are rising?
So in St. John, where we spent most of our time, there are about 5,000 people who live there year-round. I'd say about 1,000 left. But people who live there love that place.
Of course.
And it is absolutely beautiful. And there was great resolve that they would try to rebuild, that they would find a path to salvage what they had left.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the Caribbean after Irma as Hurricane Maria now bears down on the islands. How badly the Caribbean's been hit, what it faces in a time of climate change. You can join us this hour. Have you really focused on just how hard some of these islands were hit? Do you have family, friends who have lived through it, who are still there, who have got out? And will the U.S. step up for its U.S. Virgin Islands? When will it be back to business as usual on the islands? Will it be back to business as usual? Will you go this winter? What about the years ahead in this century? Roger Richards was one of the few residents allowed back to Barbuda after Hurricane Irma left the island uninhabitable. His home was one of the few still standing. Others weren't so lucky.
It's kind of hard to see all this. Up there is my friend's house too. All that has been mangled. I didn't really think about this. Seeing it make me feel like heartbroken.
On Barbuda, on St. Martin, here was the French president, Emmanuel Macron, visiting the devastated island last week, saying he wants a quick recovery there.
The situation is very critical now. Public order is under control. What I want to do is to have a very fast recovery. So we are trying to fix the situation regarding health, education, access to water, energy, and telco.
And here's Antigua and Barbuda's Prime Minister Gaston Brown again telling WLRN in Miami that the international community can't ignore the Caribbean now.
It is clear that there has to be some international support for these islands. This is an absolute need. based on the magnitude of the resources that are required to rebuild, we definitely need friendly governments like the United States to assist. So we are making an international call.
There's the international call. We'll see what the response is. And everybody watching, meanwhile, what's going on with the climate, with sea levels, with the ferocity of storms, Irma, historic on the scale of intensity over a long duration, and that really hurt. David Abel's just back from the Caribbean for the Boston Globe, and he's with us. I want to go right now to St. Lucia and Carolyn Trebetskoy. She is president of the Caribbean Hotel and Tourism Association, owner and executive director of the Anse Chastenay and Jade Mountain Resorts in St. Lucia. Carolyn, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So people may think, well, the whole Caribbean's been destroyed. That's not the case. Which islands have been hit hardest, and where will the tourism season be more or less as usual in the winter ahead, Carolyn?
Thank you, Tom. Well, first of all, let me please say that obviously our thoughts and prayers are with all of those islands that have been hit the hardest, which I'm going to describe further now, but also Florida and Texas. The Caribbean thinks of those people too, because we all have been through the same. Now, we always like to market ourselves as one region, and so the work of the Caribbean Hotel and Tourism Association is on several fronts. On the one side, we are obviously also strongly behind all of the humanitarian relief efforts. We are trying to drum up help. We are trying to also have a long-term plan to sustain the recovery. With we have partnered with tourismcares.org to raise funds. And then the other task we have is to remind everybody that, in fact, the region, the Caribbean, spans over 1 million square miles, and that the affected islands make up only about 15% of our complete room stock. Please take me as insensitive, but it is really one of my tasks to also get that across, because for us to all survive, for us to help those that are in need, we need to ensure that our visitors keep coming and keep visiting the region.
Carolyn, we know that's your job, and we've got it. We wish you'd describe to us which islands have been the worst hit so people understand what's going on.
Absolutely. So the islands that have been most affected, starting with Barbuda, as you have already mentioned, then we have St. Barts, St. Martin, and also the French St. Martin, Anguilla. We have also the British Virgin Islands, and then with the U.S. Virgin Islands, St. John and St. Thomas have been badly hit, but St. Croix is back and open for business. The Hurricane Irma also touched on the Turks and Caicos Islands in Cuba, but they were not directly in the ice, so they have fared a little better, and you will see that quite a number of resorts there are back and will open soon.
We know that tourism and visitors play a large role in these economies. The people who live there in many ways depend on this business. So will the worst hit islands that you just described be open for business this year, or will they miss a year in effect?
I think that you will have to be a little more patient, because every island has to be assessed individually. I do feel that islands like St. Martin, St. John will take longer to come back. And, of course, Barbuda, I think it's a little too soon to really comment how long it will take Anguilla or the BVIs. But, we have created a website called CaribbeanTravelUpdate.com. Where we try to update daily what's happening on every island, especially those that have been affected, so that we can really explain what's going on. And again, I think that a lot more assessments have to take place to really see how long it will take to bring the power back, water supply, and it will be different from island to island. But I think St. Martin and especially St. Martin and Anguilla will take a little longer.
Carolyn Trebetskoy with the Caribbean Hotel and Tourism Association joining us from St. Lucia. Thanks very much for being with us, Carolyn.
You're welcome.
Justin's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Justin, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that I'm a cruising sailor. There's a very large international community of sailors and families. I sail with my wife and children, and we just spent 8 months sailing through the Caribbean and left the boat there and then headed back down in the winter. But I wanted to speak to the spirit of the people down there. You know, we're not on vacation when we're traveling down there. We're immersed in the culture and meeting people. And they have been through just the absolute worst thing that I could imagine, having been there and seeing the challenges of just living on, you know, nice days. And I feel good, though, about the people. I just wanted to say that. I want to make sure everyone understands. There's people in Antigua. They speak of what they call friends and community. You know, they're not getting a lot of help from their governments or the countries that oversee.
But what do you mean you feel good about the people? They're evacuated. I mean, there's nobody on Barbuda. It's hard to feel good.
No, I understand the spirit of the people. You know, Antigua, you know, it got absolutely hammered. But yeah. People will come back, and they will certainly help one another as they've always had to do. You know, you think they're helpless people on this little rock in the middle of nowhere, but there's something really special going on down there because these people don't get a lot of help anyway, you know. So I think in the long term, I feel good about them. You know, they're not going to lean on anybody. They're going to make it work.
Well, I mean, everyone wishes them the best, no question about it. And I appreciate your call, Justin. David Abel, you've just been there. They're up against it here. And as you say, Maria coming in now on the heels of Irma.
Yeah, and just to give you an idea of what we're talking about in terms of overall damage, the numbers are rising in terms of the impact that we are aware of. But we've heard now accounts that about 45 people in the Caribbean have died as a result of the storm. That's not including the 39 who've died in the United States. And those numbers break down 10 in Cuba, 11 in St. Martin and St. Bartholomew, 4 in the British Virgin Islands, 4 in the U.S. Virgin Islands, and we're talking about upwards of $13 billion in damages that have been estimated at this point. And that includes $2.5 billion in the U.S. Virgin Islands and $2.5 billion in St. Martin, and the figures go on.
David Abel, please stand by. Frank Ackerman joins us now. He's an expert on economics, the economics of climate change and energy and environmental issues, co-author of a big report out of Tufts University a few years back, The Caribbean Islands and Climate Change, The Costs of Inaction. His forthcoming book is Worst Case Economics, Extreme Events in Climate and Finance. Frank Ackerman, you've paid a lot of attention to this region for a long time. Now here's Irma. What do you see unfolding?
Well, this is unfortunately more or less what was predictable. We did that report 9 years ago. It was nothing fancy. We took the data that was available and matched it up with the trends that climate scientists see in climate and tried to calculate what it was going to cost the region. And the numbers were disturbingly large. It was very hard for anybody to believe the kind of numbers that we got for some of the islands, what they stood to lose from the forward march of climate change.
And what were you anticipating in terms of how that would be manifested?
Well, we looked at the loss of infrastructure to sea level rise, which actually turned out to be quite a big category. We looked at hurricane damages. Just a few categories. Sea level rise in itself is a huge threat to these islands, even in the absence of storms. And when the storms occur, that it's even larger.
Let's stick with storms for a moment. There have been big storms in the Caribbean for a long time. It's Hurricane Alley down there in the hurricane season. So are we seeing something play out here that is, in your view, climate change related? Is that clear from Irma?
I think it's clear from climate science that hurricanes are not becoming more frequent, but the hurricanes that occur are becoming more intense. After a long period of debate about the science, there's pretty much of a consensus now, as I understand, that we will not see more hurricanes, but of the hurricanes that occur, more will be Category 4, Category 5 hurricanes.
And sea level rise, when does that kick in, or has it already? When does it become consequential for the Caribbean? These are all islands.
They're all islands, and they differ a lot. So the small, low-lying islands a small amount of sea level rise is catastrophic right away. The bigger islands with interior and higher elevations, Puerto Rico, Cuba, Dominican Republic, Jamaica, are not as quickly destroyed. But an awful lot of infrastructure, an awful lot of the economy is right at the shore in these islands. In the smaller islands, essentially everything is right at the shore. So there's the gradual effect of sea level rise, and then there's the fact that even a little bit of sea level rise means that storm surges are much higher.
So what does the Caribbean look like by the end of this century?
We projected that the Caribbean as a whole could lose 20% of its income, and that's an average, including the bigger islands, which have more income and aren't as exposed. Some of the small islands could be just destroyed, catastrophic losses, corresponding to the kind of thing that you're hearing about in these accounts. And this was just there was no fancy research here. It was drawing a straight line through the data and taking seriously the projections of what's going to happen.
And now Irma's come straight through. Maria is on its heels. We're looking at the Caribbean after Irma. Losing 20% of income overall, and what does that mean? Losing what kind of income?
Well, if you have roads, if you have an electric system, if you have water systems that are near enough to the coast that they're at risk from—
That's infrastructure, but you're talking about losing income. Does that mean business that somehow goes away, or it just doesn't get done because there's no road for it to be done on?
I think it's that without electricity, without roads and so on, you're pretty much crippled. You can't run a functioning economy without all of that. And at that— the loss of that kind of humdrum everyday infrastructure to sea level rise and to hurricanes is as big a piece of the picture as the more dramatic hurricanes, the loss of tourist income, which we've just heard about.
David Abel, I mean, you've just been there and seen it. Floridians are asking themselves, and we'll hear about this in this hour, you know, where do we rebuild? And what can we presume goes forward? What about in the islands you visited in the Caribbean in the aftermath of this terrible storm?
Well, I would just say, just to give you a sense of the broader picture, we're talking about islands that are that tourism is crucial for. We're talking about a $56.5 billion part of the economy there that supports more than 2.5 million jobs, representing roughly 15% of the Caribbean's gross domestic product. This is according to the World Travel and Tourism Council, which we reported on the paper the other day. And we're talking about in places like the U.S. Virgin Islands, tourism contributes to $600 million on an annual basis in those economies. And when you lose 80% of the housing, which includes hotels, which includes Airbnb places that people would rent out, there it takes a long time to rebuild those. And beyond that, we're talking about not just the natural disaster, we're talking about the concerns that were raised and that were reported about things like looting. And these were really concerning for a lot of people.
It's the social fabric in question right there.
Exactly. And that is going to also pay probably long-term a long-term toll on the future ability to bring people back to some of those places.
Look, it is what we think of when we think of paradise in many ways. But if Frank's right, if it's on a straight line trajectory toward shoreline losses and more intense storms that can do this kind of damage, is what you've heard from islanders, well, we're going to try and get back to exactly what we were, or are they envisioning a different future for themselves in the Caribbean?
I have to say one thing that was reassuring, going around St. John and St. Thomas, seeing places that were built to hurricane codes, that used hurricane glass, that used roofs that could withstand Category 4 up to Category 5 winds. Those places actually seem to do fine and make it through. And perhaps if we build properly in those places, we could see an ability to withstand the worst that is likely to come more frequently and more intensely over the coming decades.
Frank, do you buy that? You can harden the Caribbean and make it hurricane-proof, climate change-proof?
It's tremendously expensive, and you can't really proof it against sea level rise, I think, is the problem. So the desire to build right on the beach is setting you up for flooding, setting you up for the worst of the storms. The problem, I think, is that these worst-case hurricanes don't happen every year so that you can, you know, New Orleans hasn't been destroyed again since Katrina, but they happen too often to forget. The storms may
and
not be.
Somebody's running the numbers here about what gets rebuilt and what doesn't.
That's right. And it's very expensive to rebuild everything that's there to the kind of standards that David's talking about.
And yet the appetite to be there, the appetite to enjoy it when it's good, is bottomless. We're looking at the Caribbean after Irma as Hurricane Maria now bears down on the islands. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking about the Caribbean after Irma. Now looking at Maria, what got hit, the depth of the destruction, and what the future looks like for this, well, yeah, beautiful paradise region. But it's not paradise when there's a Hurricane Irma bearing down. And the talk is that they may see more of that in this century with real long-term challenges here. Frank Ackerman is with us, author of the forthcoming book, Worst Case Economics, Extreme Events in Climate and Finance. He was co-author of a big study 9 years ago out of Tufts University looking at the Caribbean and climate change. Now here we are, sort of looking at what's going on as we speak. David Abel is just back from the Caribbean, reporter for the Boston Globe, just back from the U.S. Virgin Islands, St. Thomas and St. John. He saw deep, deep destruction there. Lots of people thinking about this. Many Americans, of course, with long-term ties to the Caribbean. Eric is calling from Miami. Hi, Eric. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Tom, how are you?
Okay.
I wanted to make a comment. I was in the Leeward Islands in 1995 when the worst hurricane came through on Anguilla, subsequent to Irma. And back then in 95, I found it really interesting that nobody was heeding the warnings of this impending hurricane. Everybody we were talking to in 95, they said, it's not going to hit us. We're praying for this. It's not going to come to us. And then they would back up their justification by saying, we haven't had a hurricane since Donna in 1960, 35 years earlier. And the eye went directly over us. We had to be airlifted out. And I found the complacency astounding down in the Caribbean at that time. I'm thinking and hoping the complacency is a little less now.
I mean, certainly the warnings are heightened over time. There's no question about that. And we've got Irma with Maria right behind it. Appreciate your call. Eric AC writes to us. He says, I'm worried about how people will find shelter against Maria. What do? Tie yourself and your children to a tree. I mean, David Abel, as you say, the roofs aren't even there at the beginning of this turn to protect one. Never mind what could happen during the Maria.
Right. We're looking at a pretty tough situation. In addition to no roofs, the lack of tree cover and the lack of vegetation means that mudslides are potentially even of greater concern now. And there are large hills on places like St. John and St. Thomas, and without anything to sort of hold on to that hold on to that land, I think if it hits at a Category 4, this storm that's projected to arrive there on Wednesday, look out.
Joyce in Queenstown, Maryland. Joyce, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Great conversation. Mm-hmm. My husband and I moved to St. Croix in March of 1989, and we spent 12 hours with Hurricane Hugo on September 17th.
Wow.
We were staying in an apartment at the time. It was a garden-level apartment. All four stories above us were completely destroyed. We were in roughly 8 inches of water. My husband had a cordless drill. We were trying to screw a banquet table up against a wall to keep it from collapsing in on us. The similarities that I'm hearing from the reports now from Irma are shockingly similar. Not a blade of grass was left, not one green piece of leaf or palm frond or anything was left on the island after St. Croix. This was before the Weather Channel, and it was also before cell phones. So it wasn't that 24/7 anxiety that you get now from 24/7 reporting about the hurricane.
Yeah.
We were getting reports that the hurricane was coming, but it wasn't quite as amplified as I feel it is now when we're seeing these storms come, which are getting more frequent and stronger. We were under martial law after Hugo. There was a lot of unrestlessness and lawlessness. There was looting, and we were under curfew from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. One of the problems, as I see it from an economic standpoint, is the recovery process. They want to get it back up and running as quickly as possible, obviously, because tourism is so important to the island and so many people's livelihoods are dependent on it. But here's what they do. They keep putting the power above ground over and over and over again. Crews come down. They put telephone poles back up, power poles back up. And they come down in these very powerful hurricanes like toothpicks. To put those utilities underground, obviously, would take so much longer. But because of the economic impact, they try to rush it through. And I think this is one of the big mistakes that the islands keep making over and over again.
Well, I mean, it's hard to blame just the islands for that. We see, got all kinds of lines up anywhere you go in the U.S. as well. It's expensive to put it underground. It would be great if it were there. But that's expensive. I appreciate your call, Joyce. I mean, Frank, it gets back to the cost of toughening up the built environment if we're going to be facing a tougher intensity of storm, and what makes economic sense and what doesn't longer term.
Yeah, you can build things that'll withstand any given wind speed. I'm not sure you can build things right on the beach that will withstand sea level rise, but it's expensive. Yeah, putting wires underground makes the electric system much more reliable. It's also very expensive. And how much is the world able to spend on hardening the Caribbean infrastructures? On the bigger islands, you can move things inland. On the smaller islands, you basically can't. I'm not sure.
Everything is shoreline or not far from it.
Exactly.
Franklin in Toronto, Canada. Franklin, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I just want to make a couple of points in this excellent discussion. Firstly, I think that once or twice people have said the number of hurricanes, the frequency is not increasing. But what is increasing is the number of days they persist. So the number of hurricane days per year across the region has increased quite significantly.
Franklin, are you from the region? Is this your home turf?
I am from the region, and I spend a lot of years working on looking at natural hazards and their effects on the Caribbean.
And what do you see coming or already here, Franklin?
Well, let me tell you what is a hopeful sign.
Mm-hmm.
That the Regional Development Bank, most of the national governments are at this moment improving their building codes. They're looking at the zonation issues. They're moving things back from the very exposed shorelines. And in many cases, they're tapping into a culture of hurricanes in the region. This is a region that gave this phenomenon its name. And people have been coping with hurricanes from time immemorial. We need to marry that with the technology of engineering, because most people in the Caribbean are not running away from these islands. Barbuda has not been abandoned. A lot of people have left, the old, the young, the women. But there are people in Barbuda who intend to ride out the next system.
Well, I mean, we heard the Prime Minister saying there that it's uninhabited for the first time in 300 years. I appreciate your call, Franklin. David, I just wonder if you came away thinking, well, a couple of years, the greenery comes back and the bars are put back up on the beach and everything's back to the way it was. Or do you come back from the Virgin Islands anyway, thinking maybe it's going to have a different face in this century?
Well, I think it's going to take a long time for the place to come back to project the same kind of glamour and beauty and whimsy that people associate with a tropical island. That said, people have short-term memories, and when it gets cold up north,
mm-hmm.
people
the pull look, is strong.
People look to find a place to escape, and I'm sure that as these islands rebuild, they'll become attractive and there'll be lots of offers to go back. That said, when you think about rebuilding, and when we were talking about putting in utility lines, it was astounding to traverse these islands and see utility line after utility line down and dangerous and blocking roads. And the question I have for like a guy like Frank is, when you think about the actual finances, when we factor in climate change, does that make it more expensive ultimately to put these power lines underground and to really rebuild infrastructure?
If you may have
way
to replace them above ground every couple of years, I mean, does it add up? The Caribbean we've known, do the numbers add up, Frank?
Well, if we continue to do nothing about climate change, the numbers will fail to add up at some point. I mean, this shows how expensive it is to continue doing nothing to stop climate change and just trying to cope with it as it gets worse and worse. That road will lead to failure. That's one of the reasons why it's so urgent to reduce emissions, to get the world on track to actually controlling the problem, which is making it worse.
Rough in Florida this time with Irma, but much rougher in the Caribbean with Maria now on its way. Grateful to the two of you. David Abel, just back from the Virgin Islands. Thanks so much for coming in from the Boston Globe today. And Frank Ackerman, author of Can We Afford the Future? Thanks so much for being here, Frank. In a moment, we'll look at the future of Florida for retirees after Hurricane Irma. This is On Point. Florida's low cost of living and warm weather has long made it a destination for retirees and so-called snowbirds. But Hurricane Irma's devastation in the Sunshine State has some of those people rethinking that move south. With us now is Jessica Dickler, personal finance writer for CNBC.com. She's been writing about this. You can find her work at our website, onpointradio.org. Jessica Dickler, welcome to On Point. Your headline is Retirees Rethinking Florida Post-Irma. What's the evidence, and to go where?
Hi, Tom. Yes, the economist that I spoke to said that Florida, as the top retirement destination, could definitely be impacted after the recent hurricanes. And the retirees that I spoke to are also second-guessing their decisions. And some of the other states that are gaining ground also have nice weather and low cost of living, namely Georgia, Arizona, and the Carolinas.
So here's Florida. It's been a big destination for a long time, and it's not just the weather. You describe a kind of skein of amenities that have grown up over that time that have made it very attractive for retirees.
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, there's obviously there's an extensive availability of healthcare facilities, and then, of course, the recreation, like the beaches and golf. And there's also no personal income tax in Florida, which makes it particularly attractive for retirees hoping to kind of maintain their nest egg. But there are other states that offer low cost of living, that have nice weather, that offer golfing, maybe not the beach as much, but there are some contenders.
I mean, it's not as if everybody goes south when they retire. If I read you right, according to the Brookings Institute, less than 1% of Americans make an interstate move when they retire, but it's enough to affect the economies of many southern states.
Well, that's right. I mean, not that many retirees move in general between states, and more people are choosing to stay put, stay closer to their families, stay with their doctors that they know. But yes, these recent hurricanes could impact that even further, because there's also a psychological impact now, it seems, because there's been so many so close together with more on the horizon, that the overall impression is that it may be more dangerous now than it's been in the past.
Did you hear people saying that to you, Jessica, as they thought about retirement?
I did. I spoke to one retiree who said he'd been looking in the Miami Beach area, but was now feeling like that wouldn't be a necessarily good move for him, and, you know, what would that look like if there were more hurricanes? And even though the last string of hurricanes that really was harsh on Florida was, I mean, over 10 years ago, it feels very fresh now with so many back-to-back.
Florida's been the most attractive destination by far for seniors for a long time. What's the trend look like, though, when you compare Florida with other states where retirees may think of moving?
Well, yeah, I mean, overall, just by sheer numbers, Florida is the top spot and has been for a long time. But increasingly, there are more seniors that are looking at other states. Like I mentioned, Georgia and Arizona, even Tennessee, those have all been gaining ground.
Is there an active competition for retirees to try and woo them into these other states? Or are these all sort of, fighting for that inflow?
Well, I mean, yes, it is advantageous to have retirees coming into the state, particularly while they're still young enough and healthy enough to participate in the economy and recreation and overall, come and buy houses and spend money or condos, that sort of thing. But Florida is still hoping that this is not the end for them and that retirees, after this maybe short-term blip, that retirees will continue to move there and enjoy the Sunshine State.
It's expensive to recover from disasters like this. And, of course, Texas had it along the Gulf Coast as well. And Texas, another top retirement spot, also has no income tax. Is the no income tax policy under question as these states look at the cost of rebuilding and being ready for maybe the next storm?
Well, the no income tax definitely is a very positive thing for retirees and will make a state particularly attractive as a destination. But with these hurricanes comes an increased cost to insurance, and that plays another important role here with budgets. So if insurance costs go up, as they likely will, then that will bring up the overall cost of living and make other states relatively more attractive.
A storm comes through and it does its damage and we wring our hands and more over it, and then the sun comes back out and people want to be someplace comfortable. What do you think it would take to really change these flows, Jessica, of retirees and where they end up? Do you think Irma is enough to do that?
Well, it probably remains to be seen. I do think, and the economists that I spoke to did think, that there would be an impact here after other storms in the past, particularly Hurricane Katrina. Louisiana saw a negative impact to their in-migration in the 5 years that followed. This will likely not be that bad, but some of it may depend on how Florida rebuilds or chooses to rebuild and what happens with insurance costs and other cost of living factors.
Jessica Dickler, writing for CNBC.com about retirees rethinking Florida and considering other destinations after Irma. Jessica, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, be first to find out tomorrow's topics and guests by going to our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Hit that like button. You'll get alerts on upcoming shows right there in your news feed. Our podcast is always available to you. Check it out anytime, any place. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Camila Kerwin, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Allison Poley, and James Ross. With help from Gretchen Voss, Anna Bauman, and Whitley Leonard, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.